Greece, Kenosha, 37 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
I'm sure that many of you are well acquainted with the organization known as Toastmasters. And Toastmasters International is actually an organization that in all kinds of different ways seek to make more and more people comfortable with what is actually a very fearful proposition for a lot of people, public speaking. And the thing is, if that fear is allowed to remain in place, it can be such a limiting thing in one's personal life, in one's professional life, in so many different respects. And it can make all the difference in the world when one has an ease in expressing oneself and in speaking in front of others. And that is at the heart and soul of the mission of Toastmasters International. A spring conference for Toastmasters is coming up on May 6th at the Abbey in Lake Geneva, celebrating 70 years of activity with this particular branch of Toastmasters. And they have a very, very important guest speaker coming in to help them celebrate, namely Monica Rose, who is the international director of Toastmasters International. And I'm very honored to be able to have her on the phone with me for the next few minutes to talk about Toastmasters and the various ways in which they seek to make a difference for the better in people's lives. Monica Rose, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here, Greg.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. And over the years, I've certainly heard a lot about Toastmasters, and I know several people who in one way or another have benefited from your work. But I'm pretty sure in my many years of doing the morning show, this is, I think, likely the very first time we've actually had a conversation directly about it. So I really welcome that. Can you give us first a kind of a historical sketch of the organization? How long have you been around, and what can you tell us about the founding of Toastmasters?
I'm excited and delighted to do that. The organization has been around since 1924, so we're approaching our 100-year mark in changing lives to many people around the world. The humble beginnings began in 1924 with our founder, Dr. Ralph Smedley, who worked at the YMCA and started this conversation with a group of young men. He wanted to see them grow in their confidence and in their leadership and speaking. So that was the beginning of it. It all started in California, Santa Ana, California, and has just blossomed throughout the world. There are over 280,000 members right now, and the impact is represented in 144 countries. So I'm just really excited that we began that way, and the program has continued for many years through a lot of changes as well. So thank you for that question.
Well, and it seems to me that the longevity of this organization, the fact that you're approaching your century mark, it really says something, doesn't it, about kind of the fundamental nature and fundamental importance of this issue. I mean, it's obviously something that a lot of people grapple with, and there are a lot of people who want help with it. And Toastmasters is one of the chief ways in which people can get help. In a sense, dealing with and or conquering this fear.
Absolutely. The one thing that makes it really, it dispels some of the fear, is once you get interested in the organization, there's many clubs around the world or chapters in some corporate environment. But the way you can get involved is just to take a look at where you can find a club. And what that is in that small environment, the mission of that experience is to provide that safe and supportive environment. So just coming in and being able to be welcomed in and be greeted in a way that says, hey, we're welcoming you into the organization or welcoming you into the environment so you can learn. And there's an opportunity to give that very first speech, and it's all about yourself. So you can talk for maybe 2 or 3 minutes on a topic that you're very familiar of, yourself. That's what we call the icebreaker. It's an opportunity just to share who you are. And because it's about yourself, it's pretty easy to do sometimes.
Right. If you were asked to give a presentation on some topic in which expertise is required, that might be really daunting. But if it's for you just talking about yourself, giving some background, and maybe talking about something that you already really love and know a lot about, I can see how that would be a really great first step. Tell us how typically a person comes in contact with Toastmasters International. I mean, what is usually the scenario in which somebody makes contact and gets help from you?
One of the first ways might be first a personal contact, word of mouth. I have a friend who invited me to join the organization. That's how I first heard about it. Usually sometimes the clubs will have an open house and will promote that in the community or through their corporate environment to let them know the organization will have a meeting. And please come, and if you have that fear, please step forward and join us on Monday. Say if the meetings are on Monday, please join us at this time. It's just a welcome to come in. So that's how we might do it. We're doing a radio announcement right now. Sometimes chapters will have radio announcements or even announcements on the TV station for members who have never heard about Toastmasters to come and join into a meeting and learn about all of what the program has to offer.
So you joined Toastmasters out of the kind of fear that we're talking about? I mean, a fear of public speaking or a desire to be more comfortable doing that? Is that right?
Yes. I joined out of fear. That example I shared with you in my corporate environment, my background is engineering. I'm a mechanical engineer. With that, sometimes we don't have our thoughts all together, and we love the quietness of our office and never really branch out from what our work is. And my friend noticed that I might have not been as extroverted as she was, and noted that experience for me that the Toastmasters program would be of great benefit. So she said, Monica, you should come and visit. So it was that word of mouth that inspired me to visit a club. I went for a couple of times, and I saw the ease. I was welcomed in, the ease of just sharing my 2 minutes opportunity to share who I was and just to say hi. My hands were still trembling at that moment, but I knew that if I wanted to be a more confident leader, to have that experience, to have a better relationship at work, to show that confidence and build my skill, I knew that that was a program that I wanted to do so that I can have that personal growth experience. And I'm so glad I did. That was almost 17 years ago. And I still remember that moment. They asked me to join, and before I knew it, I was off doing all kinds of things that I'd never done before. There was a program where we worked from a manual that talked about how to give that first opening speech. Then there was a next project that talked about how to craft your speech. So I could see the progression of going from just that slight fear. It wasn't a fear of death or anything. It wasn't that shocking, but just to see that there was a program along the way that could help me, and I could do this at my own pace. I said, this is for me. And then it was just the communication that I might have thought about that I wanted to develop further. But once I got into the program and I learned that there was a leadership component, I really got hooked, because that was one thing I knew as an engineer, aspiring to go to the higher ranks, lead mechanical engineer, supporting teams. I needed those skills to help me build that confidence in myself and the learnings that it required, were required for my job. So I saw the future of me being a more confident leader and more money in my pocket, because that came with promotions and the ability to command the team when I needed to. So I saw the value of that experience.
We're speaking with Monica Rose, who is International Director of Toastmasters International, and she's going to be the keynote speaker for the spring conference of the local chapter, if you will, of Toastmasters, that event on May 6th at the Abbey in Lake Geneva. One of the things I noticed from visiting Toastmasters' website is that there are a number of different formats in which Toastmasters does their work, and I suspect that at least some of that might be due to necessity during the COVID-19 pandemic. That is, there are opportunities in person, but also opportunities virtual and some hybrid opportunities as well. And it sounds like you want to encourage people to think about what format or scenario might work best for them. Can you tell us more about kind of the various ways in which this important work takes place?
Absolutely, Greg. In the in-person opportunity, you can visit clubs in the Wisconsin area. There's an opportunity to go online to see. Toastmasters.org is the website, and you'll do find a club. So you can find out where the clubs are that meet in your neighborhood. So that's an in-person experience. That's in the club environment where you can visit and shake hands and say hi and learn all about the program. Online, we have a Pathways Education program that will give you that online experience. Once you log in onto the Toastmasters.org website, you can look under Pathways or Education Programs. And that will give you an idea of the entire program. It's in electronic format. You can take the assessment. It will give you suggested paths for you to investigate that might pique your interest on what you might want to develop in yourself. There's an array of paths that talk about dynamic leadership, project mastery, help in conflict resolution. So you can go through each one of those programs. There's a cost associated with it. It's very affordable at $45 for the membership for a six-month period. But this gives you an opportunity to learn about all kinds of things to help you be a better communicator and leader.
One of the things that I think some people might assume is that this is about, in a sense, conquering a fear. I mean, if one is truly terrified of getting up in front of other people and speaking publicly. And I think it's probably important for people to understand that Toastmasters is about more than that. It's also about becoming better and better at it. In other words, it isn't about coming to a couple of meetings and not being so scared anymore and then kind of leaving it behind, although I suppose it's possible to do that. But my understanding is that it's also about becoming more and more comfortable and more skilled as a communicator in public settings. Is that right?
That's correct. The more we craft our speeches, the more exposure that you get. There's different projects that will help you to plan an event or to host a meeting with step-by-step processes and how to bring people across on your team. I find that in my work, I am also invited to give not only keynotes, but to talk on different topics, such as in an education session on conflict resolution or teamwork building skills. Every time I sign up for a speech, I learn more and more. It helps in our preparation to understand the audience. So I have to do a little investigative work and this helps to hone my presentations every time. So just like I'm trained as a scuba diver, the more downtime I have in the scuba diving world, I get better just the same. In Toastmasters, the more speeches I give or the more speeches I attend and listen from others, I learn as well from listening. So that's a great point.
I am really excited to hear about the international scope of Toastmasters. I'm just curious the way this plays out in other countries, in other cultures. Do you find that there are, in a sense, different issues that need to be confronted or different means by which to achieve these goals? Or by and large, are we talking about just kind of fundamentally human issues that can be essentially addressed the same way, whether we're talking about somebody in California or someone in Cairo, Egypt, or wherever somebody may be?
Fundamentally, we all have the same concerns. The fear is there. The program works the same way. The only difference is, as you mentioned, is the culture and the language. We have materials in multiple languages, so it definitely makes the individual comfortable because they can read and understand the program or matriculate through the program in their own language. The culture is just unique. That's the only thing. But overall, we all look at the same concerns.
So tell us about coming to Southeastern Wisconsin for this big event on May 6th and what you are planning to say at this special event.
My keynote will be on keys to success. We'll talk a little bit about the keys in teamwork and definitely keys to success in connecting the dots of what the program means from when the first member comes in to where they can go in their own personal development. There's many keys to success in that regard. So I hope to inspire and motivate and share some personal examples of my journey through the program and help to give the visual expression of we're all connected in a certain way, and the program can help you. Once you take one step, you can leap into many other opportunities. I'm excited about sharing that and having us all work together because that's what it's all about.
Monica Rose is International Director of Toastmasters. Monica Rose, it was great to meet you. Great to have you on the morning show today. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you and all who are associated with Toastmasters.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Toastmasters District 35 hosts their spring conference on May 5th and 6th at the Abbey Resort in Lake Geneva. It will be a hybrid event, and it will include pre-conference virtual education presentations April 30th through May 3rd, each evening 7 to 8 p.m. The conference itself will include a tall tale speech contest on May 5th and an international speech contest on May 6th. And, of course, the keynote speaker for the event is International Director Monica Rose. If you'd like more information about Toastmasters or this event, you can go to their website, www.district35.org. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's morning show, we're going to be hearing from the great singer Brian Stokes Mitchell, who is going to be performing this Friday evening with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, An Evening with Brian Stokes Mitchell at Bradley Symphony Center. In honor of that occasion, I'm replaying a conversation from some years ago when Brian Stokes Mitchell came to sing here in southeastern Wisconsin. Here is that conversation, which begins actually with an excerpt from one of his most memorable performances on Broadway in the title role of The Man of La Mancha.
Hear me now, thou bleak and unbearable world, thou art base and debauched as can be. And the knight, with his banners all bravely unfurled, now hurls down his gauntlet to thee. I, Don Quixote, the Lord of La Mancha. My destiny calls and I go. And the wild winds of
And that magnificent voice and unmistakable artistry belong to Brian Stokes Mitchell. Brian Stokes Mitchell, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Greg, thank you. It's great being with you again. Thanks for having me.
It's just great to talk to somebody who is so renowned, and we have lots to talk about. I believe when we talked last, we did not talk very much about your childhood. And as I read up a bit more about you, it turns out that you had quite an interesting childhood, uncommon in that you, if I understand correctly, grew up on military bases because your father, who I think was a civilian, did work for the U.S. Navy. Tell us about this aspect of your childhood and the significance of it in terms of the ways in which that kind of childhood maybe shaped who you are.
Yeah, great questions. Thank you. It's interesting because, you know, I think when you're a kid and up until maybe your 20s, you think, oh, everybody has the same life. And you don't realize that your childhood or everybody's life is very unique. And mine certainly was as well. My father, as you said, was a civilian working for the Navy. I was born in Seattle when we were six. We moved down to San Diego, but only for 9 months. Then he got transferred to Guam. So when I was 6 years old, we lived in Guam for 2 years. And then after that, we moved to Subic Bay in the Philippines, and I lived there for 6 years. So I didn't move back to the United States until I was about 14 years old, going into the ninth grade. And it was a really great place and a beautiful place. It's kind of like small town America growing up on a Navy base, except for you've got a jungle in your backyard and monkeys coming down and poisonous snakes in your house and things like that. I was a Boy Scout there, and I learned to make rice cookers and canteens with bamboo and all kinds of interesting things. I went on the Bataan Death March, which was a 50-mile hike that happened, it was commemorating the Death March from World War II as well. So I had lots of really interesting experiences. And on reflection, I realized that it prepared me perfectly for the life that I have now, because as a performer, as an actor, particularly on Broadway, but also in film and television as well, you get very close with a bunch of people very quickly. They become your family. You see them at their best. You see them at their worst. And then at some point, it's all over, and you're gone, and those people are gone, and you may or may not ever see them again. And that was very much what my childhood was like, with people coming in from different parts of the United States to the Navy bases. And some of them I have seen and kept up with, and most of them I have not. So I guess I had to be an actor. That and being born on Halloween, which is, you know, the day people dress up and pretend to be other people. What else could I have done with my life?
Right. For as fascinating as that life was, you probably didn't have a whole lot of opportunity for, I don't know, piano lessons and summer plays and that sort of thing. Opportunities that would be more sort of easily available for somebody living a more ordinary childhood. Can I assume that your love of, for instance, theater and music came a little bit later once you had settled down back in the United States?
Well, yes, actually, the deep part of it, I would say, did. But my brother George, who's been a professional costume designer now all of his life, he was the first thespian in the family and started that actually in the Philippines.
Huh.
I was exposed actually to quite a bit of theater through the USO. And it was interesting because when I was in my mid-20s, I actually did a USO tour. I've done two USO tours, and I went back to Subic Bay in the Philippines, which had not changed at all. There was still one light on the entire base. And I went back and I performed at the Station Theater, which is where I had seen probably, 50 USO shows. And I remember the very first musical I saw was A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which was Stephen Sondheim's show, of course. And I thought it was one of the funniest things that I'd ever seen in my life. I later found out that one of the cast members was Jeffrey Tambor in that show. Somebody sent me a picture of the cast that was from that company. And my brother George, because of his interest in the theater, he was acting and doing community theater there and was kind of the high school star and the high school class president and everything as well. I'm the youngest, and he is the oldest boy in the family. Because of that, I was exposed through our stereo to all of these different musical theater composers, and he particularly loves Stephen Sondheim. So I heard a lot of his work when I was younger. So and the music part of it actually started on Guam. My parents say that I asked for an organ. I wanted to play the organ. I don't remember that or why, but they ended up getting me a fan organ, and immediately I was obsessed with the instrument, and I sat down with it, and I would sit with it for hours and play with it and play with the notes and the tones. And I was fascinated by the way certain combinations of my fingers on the keys would not only sound, but more so would make me feel. And I think that was my first connection of how music can connect you to your emotions and give you joy and give you sadness and give you all of these different things through this kind of alchemy of sound.
Hmm. So when you were reaching, for instance, high school, it sounds like you were already very intent on a professional career in music or theater or both. Was that kind of a war within yourself in terms of where you wanted to focus your passions?
No, actually not so much, because music was always my place in the family. My next oldest brother, John, was also involved in theater, and my sister, Lorna, who was the oldest of all the kids, she was the first musician in the family. So what happened was when we moved back to the United States, all of a sudden I found myself in a high school. My brother George was graduated. My sister was out of the house at that point. She was the oldest, as I said. And my brother John was in a high school. And they asked me, do you want to take chorus or band or drama? And I was so tired of taking chorus and band because that's what I took every year. And I thought, well, there's no more fraternal competition. Let me try drama. And I took my first acting class in ninth grade in Kathleen Lund's ninth grade class. And the very first scene I ever did was, this occurred to me much later, was Good Morrow, Kate, for That's Your Name, I Hear, which was, of course, from The Taming of the Shrew. And that later occurred to me when I was sitting in the theater at the Martin Beck Theater right after I had won my Tony, and a bunch of young people came in and they were doing scenes from The Taming of the Shrew, and I saw some young 14-year-old young man come in and do that scene, and it hit me, oh my God, that was the very first scene I ever did in acting class, and here I am now sitting in a Broadway theater. Having just won a Tony Award for that, just the amazing, you know, circles that life makes. But when I was in San Diego, my father worked at that time he'd retired from the Navy and ended up working for Scripps Institute of Oceanography, and I had this great fascination, as I still do, with science and particularly marine biology. So I was thinking of being a marine biologist, but still, every day I was playing the piano or the organ. I was very obsessed by it, and I was starting to teach myself orchestration and arranging as well. And I had also grown up kind of with a tape recorder, a studio in my house, because my father was an electronics engineer. So we would always get the old tape recorder, and when he upgraded, and my brother John and I used to play for hours recording and making radio shows and making music on these things. So it was kind of a natural extension, but I really wasn't thinking about it professionally until probably around the 11th or 12th grade. I started actually working professionally in San Diego in the theater at the Old Globe and the San Diego Civic Light Opera. And also I was in a group called The Bright Side, which was like the Young Americans, which traveled every place performing, and those were my jobs actually then, and I think that's when I realized, oh, maybe I have something here. Maybe there's some kind of, you know, a promising future. Maybe not. Who knows?
Of course, the world now knows you for the amazing performances that you have delivered, particularly on the Broadway stage and in an array of marvelous shows. But your very first splash actually, in terms of nationwide recognition, came with your delightful work on a little TV show called Trapper John MD. And I should mention before I forget, you're actually the second member of that cast that I have interviewed on this program. More than 30 years ago, I interviewed Charles Siebert because he was born and raised right here in Kenosha, Wisconsin, where our radio station is located. And
you know what? I forgot about that. Charlie Siebert and I still keep in touch. I just love him. I learned so much from him during Trapper John, and I'm sure I stole a lot from him as well because he had incredible comedic technique. And I forgot that he was from Kenosha. My wife, by the way, I think we might have talked about, is from Milwaukee. So I spent lots of time in Wisconsin. I have these constant connections up there, which is really nice. So that's fantastic.
But great.
Trapper John kind of put me on the national map. But it was interesting. People didn't realize that I was musical on that show. And I kind of kept that hidden because I was raised in musical theater and I always sang. But I actually made a conscious choice not to sing on the show, even if they asked me or even make any overtures that I would like to do that, because I kind of wanted to keep some secrets and some things, you know, that I could reveal later. What I did do on that show, which was wonderful, I started studying through UCLA film scoring, conducting, orchestration, and arranging, and I ended up scoring a number of the shows on Trapper John because it's something that I've always been fascinated with. And so that was my first opportunity to do that. And it was just a magical time in my life because the producers, Don Brinkley and Frank Glicksman, loved Broadway people. So we had lots of Broadway folks that I had been listening to on these albums from my childhood coming into my living room, so to speak. And I got to meet, you know, and talk to them, Roddy McDowell and Rita Moreno and Celeste Holm and all kinds of other stars as well. So it was a really great learning experience for me.
Wow. I'm so glad you said that, because one of my questions was going to be something to the effect that how in the world did you go on to do what you did on Broadway, given the fact that I mean, this what you did on this television show, which was a rather lighthearted, lovely show, certainly not a heavy drama, and your character specifically was not given to heavy dramatic moments. Watching that, we would never imagine what you would go on to do. And I would never have imagined any kind of connection. It's like two different careers, almost two different lives.
Yeah, that's why I do call that, it was like a lifetime ago. But I always had it in my head that that I wanted to do theater. And it's interesting because I was making observations while I was doing the show, and one of the things that I did observe was from other friends and people that had gotten off of television shows at the time, that they couldn't get arrested after that. One of the downsides of being on a television series, especially one that runs a long time, is that people see you every week. You're in their living room, sometimes more than that if they're reruns, and they become kind of weary, and they think they know you and know everything that you do. And I knew I had some surprises in my back pocket, but after Trapper John, I could hardly get arrested because everybody wanted the new shiny toy, of course, and I wasn't that anymore. So I ended up going into voiceover work. I went into a lot of animated voiceover work, which I still do. And then I thought, you know what, I want to do theater again. And there was an opportunity at the Pasadena Playhouse to get into a show called Mail, M-A-I-L, that ended up being a big hit there. I ended up getting the role, and that was my first Broadway show. That was the show that took me through the Kennedy Center and then on to Broadway. But we only ran 2 months. But it was my entree, and I won what's called a Theater World Award, which is an award that's given every season to people making their Broadway debuts, about 20 people. And I didn't really understand the depth and wonderful nature of that gift when I received it. I found out later I was in incredible company with that. Just about anybody famous that's ever been on Broadway has received that award, and I was one of the lucky ones to get it. And to this day, it is one of my favorite awards that I've ever won.
Hmm. We're speaking with Brian Stokes Mitchell. your hallmark in terms of the amazing work you have done on Broadway has been a really interesting mix of some shows that have been just wall-to-wall bubbly fun, coupled with other works that have been much more wrenching and intense. And I suspect that that's one of the things that makes a career on Broadway such a rich experience, is the fact that you get to, in a sense, explore and experience such wide variation of emotional life.
Absolutely. It's one of the things that I've loved the most about it, is it's giving me this great opportunity to explore all of these different human beings. And that's kind of what you get to do as a performer. As a child, I remember I had a term for it, but maybe from the time I was 6 or 7 years old, I used to look at people and watch people, and I wished I could, my term was, blow myself into them and feel what it felt like to be them. Did it feel the same to walk for them that it does for me? Do they see colors the same way that I do? Do they hear sounds the same way that I do? You know, what does it feel like to be them? And, of course, I could never do that, but what I realized is much later on in my life, that's what I end up doing as an actor. I kind of blow myself into these different people and these different personas and with these different walks of life and points of view. And it's very eye-opening to be, I think, an artist and particularly a performer, because, you know, that saying of walking a 1,000 miles in someone else's shoes, in a sense, as a performer, you get to do that. You have to fall in love with the person, whoever it is that you're playing, whether they're, you know, a darker kind of soul, like in Kiss of the Spider Woman or Jelly's Glass Jam, or even in Ragtime, where Cole House Walker ends up going, or King Headley, the August Wilson play that I did, or whether they're somebody lighter like Fred Graham in Kiss Me, Kate, you know, or Don Quixote in Man of La Mancha. But you get to explore all of these different personas, and I think it's really wonderful because it allows anybody, and you don't even have to do this professionally. You can do this in your community theater, in your high school. It's why I think arts are so important in school, particularly, is it allows people to see something greater than themselves, to realize there's more than themselves, and it gives people a great sense of empathy and understanding, and you kind of embrace your life, and you understand how you're different, how you're the same as everybody else, and kind of what connects us all, and that continues to be what I love to do, not only with films and television and Broadway, but also in my concerts as well. I kind of like to embody these different characters from the songs that I'm singing.
By the way, I wonder what it is. How is it a different experience to, for instance, be a part of something brand new exploding on the scene like Ragtime in 1998 versus bringing to the public a show that they already know, like Kiss Me, Kate, for which you won the Tony, or something like Sweeney Todd or South Pacific, when you are, in a sense, treading in the shoes of those who have gone before you in that show, in that very role which you are now performing. How different are those two experiences or undertakings for you?
Well, there are a lot of differences, but a lot of similarities as well. The main difference is, of course, is you're creating something from scratch that nobody has seen before. They may have experienced it in a book or in a film, but especially in a musical, that's a very different kind of art form. So you get to define what this character is going to look like, walk like, sound like, as opposed to doing something like Kiss Me, Kate or Man of La Mancha. The audience has an idea of what these songs are already, the idea of what the show is, and what happens with the show. So in that sense, you're trying to rediscover or actually discover new things about the character and about the songs. And also make that connection, because this is the most important thing, I think, for an actor, is you have to make a very personal connection to those characters. So even though I listened to the Richard Kiley album a lot when I heard Man of La Mancha, and Ezio Pinza when I was listening to South Pacific when I was younger, and I stole a lot from those guys, by the way, in their technique, because they're big baritones as well. When you finally get a hold of those roles to play on your own, you have to find a personal connection. What makes me respond to this person? What would I do in that situation? And also, I made a very conscious effort when I approached the song The Impossible Dream, for instance, to do it differently, because that song is one of the most beloved songs in the world. Mitch Lee, who wrote the music for it, told me that when he goes to Germany, or when he went to Germany, he's since passed away, and performed that song, the Germans would come up to him after the show and say, "Oh, thank you for writing The Impossible Dream. That's so German." And he'd go to Japan, and the Japanese would say, "Oh, thank you for writing The Impossible Dream. It's such a Japanese song." And it's the hallmark of a great song is a song that everybody can relate to like that. And so what I wanted to do is discover what's going to be different for me in that song. And I decided to tread in what I call the spaces of the material, as opposed to Richard Kiley saying these long, "To dream the impossible dream," you know, these long phrases. And I thought, let me pull that apart a little bit, because that song is more, for me, a question and answer. You know, the question is, to dream what? Answer, the impossible dream. To fight who? The unbeatable foe. So there was this implied question in the spaces, and I thought, let me put a little space in there. And it kind of allowed me to rediscover and invent the song. So that's what you try to do when you're doing a new role as well, I think.
I love that. What is it like for you to step on the concert stage, where you are, in a sense, shorn of the trappings of a full-staged production? No set, no costumes, and in most cases, no castmates. And in what way is that an experience that feels like less than something, and maybe at the same time more than something?
Yeah. I have to say, I think if I had to pick one thing to do of all the things that I've done, television, film, voiceovers, all of that, Broadway, it would probably be concerts. It's what I love the best. Yeah, it almost feels like everything that I've ever done and been trained to do feeds best into the concert world. And I love it because, for one thing, it's always different. Every audience is different. Sometimes I do a concert with an orchestra, sometimes like I'm doing with the Chicago Philharmonic, a fantastic orchestra, by the way. I'm so looking forward to working with them again, or playing with them again, as I like to say. Sometimes it's with a jazz band. Sometimes it's with a trio. You know, sometimes it's just with a solo piano. And it's always different. And every audience is different. And it's one of the things that I love about the theater. But unlike the theater, where you're doing 8 shows a week, it's the same show every time, and you're exploring the spaces, I can change the show up as much as I want. I can throw in different songs. I'm working on a new album now called Plays with Music that's going to be released in this fall. And so I'm introducing many of those songs in the concert as well. And you have a kind of different way to play with it. And because it is just me, I have all kinds of freedom. I can say what I want. If something just pops into my head, if something happened during the day, I like to make storytelling a part of it as well, because what I want people to be left with, and this is largely in my control when I'm doing a concert like this, I want them to feel happier, more joyful leaving than they did when they came in. For me, the theater in general and the arts in general, but particularly the theater and concerts, for me, are kind of like a church. And I feel like a good church, when you go to church, you should leave church feeling much better than you did when you walked in. More hopeful, more joyful, more excited, more empathetic, more connected, more yourself, more curious, more all of those things. And that's one of the things that I try to connect people with, because I like to connect with those things. And I think sometimes for those that want to go there with you. When you bring that energy onto the stage, it's kind of a contagious energy that hits the audience as well. And it becomes this wonderful synergistic kind of energy exchange that happens between the audience and not only me, but the orchestra and the conductor and the people on stage as well. And it's just a wonderful way to make a living. I feel like the luckiest human being in the world.
Right. Renowned baritone Brian Stokes Mitchell performs this Friday night with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. To finish out the morning show today, here he is in an excerpt from a memorable concert performance of Rodgers and Hammerstein's South Pacific opposite Reba McEntire, singing the great anthem, Some Enchanted Evening.
Even if it seems foolish to be so quick, I know it is only 2 weeks. A dinner given at your officer's club. Do you remember?
Yes, I remember.
And that is the way things happen sometimes, isn't it, Nelly?
Yes, it is, Emil.
Some enchanted evening, you may see a stranger. You may see a stranger across a crowded room, and somehow you know even then that somewhere you'll see her again and again. Some enchanted evening, someone may be laughing, you may hear her laughing across a crowded room, and night after night, as strange as it seems, the sound of her can explain it, who can tell you why? Fools give you reasons, wise men never try. Some enchanted evening, when you find your true love, when you feel her call you, to her side and make her your own. All through your life you may dream all alone. Once you have found her, never let her go. Once you have found her, never let her go.
Baritone Brian Stokes Mitchell performs this Friday night with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, and you can go to their website for more information. It's a minute before 9 o'clock. Tomorrow on the morning show, the author of a book called The Orpheus Clock, One Family in Search of Their Art Treasures That Were Stolen by the Nazis. On Thursday, we preview the upcoming main stage musical at Carthage, Legally Blonde, and on Friday, a preview of this weekend's performances of Carthage's Opera Workshop. In memory of Mozart, a tribute to a singular genius. Cloudy skies in our forecast today. Light rain on and off this morning. Partly sunny by the afternoon with a high of 49. Clear overnight, low of 30. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 51. We do hope that you'll take a moment to participate in the spring membership drive for Wisconsin Public Radio. And when you do, please mention that you're a listener to WGTD. We're approaching 9 o'clock. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.